Happy New Year! Welcome to the January 2017 edition of Annotated Bibliography Podcast, also known as Journal Scan, or this month in other journals besides the AJNR. I'm Jeff Ross, and for this edition, I've selected 9 articles from the recent literature that I have found of interest. The first paper is by Akudad, and it is entitled Association of Cerebral Microbleeds with Cognitive Decline and Dementia. This is from JAMA Neurology in 2016. The authors wanted to determine whether microbleed count and location were associated with an increased risk for cognitive impairment and dementia. They evaluated a prospective population-based study set in the general community and assessed the presence, number, and location of microbleeds at baseline, going from August 2005 to December 2011. This was on brain MRs in 4,841 participants 45 years or older. Trained research physicians blinded to clinical data reviewed the MRs. Cerebral microbleeds were defined as small, round to oval areas of focal signal loss on T2-weighted images. Participants underwent neuropsych testing at 2 time points approximately 6 years apart, and were also followed for incident dementia. 3,257 participants underwent baseline and follow-up cognitive testing. Microbleed prevalence was 15%. The presence of more than 4 microbleeds was associated with cognitive decline. The presence of microbleeds was associated with an increased risk for dementia after adjustment for age, sex, education level, and including Alzheimer's dementia. The strengths of this study, according to the authors, is the longitudinal population-based design with a large sample size and use of extensive neuropsych test battery and the virtually complete screening for incident dementia. Limitations included multiple statistical tests, including the chance of type 1 errors. Second, selection bias could have influenced the results because healthier people without subjective memory complaints were more likely to receive follow-up cognitive testing. Most importantly, perhaps, the microbleed number may not reflect the true biological number because microbleed detection strongly depends on technical imaging methods used. T2-weighted images were used, and as we know, susceptibility-weighted imaging is far superior for the detection of these lesions. 4 tables to take a look at in that paper. All right, let's go on to the number 2 paper. This has an author of Manoso, and it is entitled Floating Lateral Mass Fractures of the Cervical Spine, and this is from Spine in 2016. This is an uncommon and poorly described subset of cervical spine fracture dislocations, and it's called the floating lateral mass fracture, which includes fractures of the adjacent pedicle and lamina. The purpose of this study was to characterize this so-called floating lateral mass fracture with the mechanism of injury, anatomical injury pattern, associated vascular injuries, neurologic deficits, and key radiographic features from a prospectively collected trauma registry from 2007 to 2012. 60 consecutive cases were identified from the trauma registry. The mean follow-up was 9 months. The most common level was C6. The most common mechanism of injury was, no doubt here, a high-speed motor vehicle accident in 45%. Radiographic, or CT and MR, more appropriately, rotational displacement was manifested as an anterolisthesis. CT showed facet joint widening at the level above and below in 63%. Vertebral artery injuries occurred in 22%. Neurological deficits occurred as radiculopathy in about 38% and cord injury in 18%. The radiographic or imaging hallmark is the horizontalization of the lateral mass, best seen on the parasagittal views of the CT with subluxation and opening of the facet joint above and below the level of injury, and that occurred in 63%. Subluxation and rotational listhesis was seen in about 73%. MR demonstrated a significant disc injury in 80% and with a lower level involved in about 3/4 of the cases. So this is a useful paper to take a look at for the imaging and that really typical horizontalization of the lateral mass, which is quite easily identified on the sagittal views, both MR and CT. There are 5 figures in this paper and 4 tables. Let's go on to number 3. It has the first author of Pullum, and this is entitled Prognostic Value of Mid-Treatment FDG PET in Oropharyngeal Cancer. This is from Head Neck in 2016. The authors retrospectively examined pre-treatment and mid-treatment FDG PET parameters in patients with locally advanced oropharyngeal cancer who were treated with definitive chemoradiation. They hypothesized that mid-treatment FDG PET parameters can help identify those who are responders or non-responders during treatment, which will correlate with disease control and survival. They conducted a retrospective review of 74 patients with stage 3 to 4B oropharyngeal squamous cell carcinoma who received definitive chemoradiation. Patients were included only if they underwent both pre-treatment and mid-treatment FDG PET planning scans. Mid-treatment metabolic tumor volume using a threshold of SUV of 2 was associated with progression-free survival and overall survival. Nodal total lesion glycolysis velocity of greater than 5% decrease per week was associated with improved progression-free survival. They conclude that the study suggests that mid-treatment PET parameters, as characterized by metabolic tumor volume and total lesion glycolysis, can be prognostic for disease progression and death in patients with oropharyngeal cancer. So 3 figures and 3 tables for this paper. Onward to number 4. This has a first author of Rawal, and it is entitled Endoscopic Resection of Sinonasal Malignancy, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This is from Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery from 2016. The expanded endonasal approach has allowed for extirpation of benign sinonasal tumors via the minimally invasive technique since its introduction around 1996. While endonasal approach indications continue to broaden for benign disease processes, open craniofacial resection continues to be the gold standard for extirpation of malignant sinonasal tumors. The preference of open technique is often driven by the desire for an en bloc resection of tumor with negative margins, rather than a progressive resection with negative margins. However, after 2 decades since the introduction of endoscopic technology, and with continued advancement of hemostatic techniques, reconstruction, and safety precautions, its use in malignant disease continues to increase. 35 case series were included in this analysis, consisting of 952 patients. A wide variety of tumor types were included in these papers, including adenoid cystic carcinoma, melanoma, squamous cell carcinoma, sinonasal adenocarcinoma, and sinonasal undifferentiated carcinoma. 2- and 5-year survival rates for patients in aggregate modeling were 87% and 72%, respectively. So they concluded that the overall 2- and 5-year survival rates are comparable and sometimes greater than those from open craniofacial resection. Survival rates significantly differed by cancer grade, but not by cancer stage. So there are 4 tables and 8 figures, but the figures are mainly Kaplan-Meier curves. Let's go on to number 5 then. This has a first author of Samuel, and it is entitled Management of Acute Traumatic Central Cord Syndrome. This is from Contemporary Spine Surgery in 2016. This is a very nice and succinct review of the clinical presentation and pathophysiology of acute traumatic central cord syndrome and operative management. First described in 1954, acute traumatic central cord syndrome is the most common form of incomplete cervical spinal cord injury. Acute central cord syndrome accounts for 70% of incomplete cervical cord injuries and occurs in approximately 11,000 patients annually. Acute traumatic central cord syndrome is distinguished from other spinal cord pathologies as the deficit is primarily related to the central regions of the cord and classically affects upper extremities more than lower extremities. Acute traumatic central cord syndrome has a bimodal age distribution, with younger patients suffering higher energy injuries in the setting of congenital cervical spinal stenosis, and older patients suffering low energy injuries in the setting of degenerative cervical stenosis. Of the different spinal cord injury syndromes, acute traumatic central cord syndrome has demonstrated the greatest potential for improvement of neurologic symptoms, even with conservative therapy. While early reports focused on non-operative treatment, more recent studies with advancements in imaging techniques have demonstrated that operative treatment of patients with acute traumatic central cord syndrome is both safe and efficacious for speeding up and optimizing potential neurologic recovery. Timing of surgery remains controversial. In one study of more than 900 spine surgeons, only 13% agreed that operating within 2 to 4 hours is indicated after an acute traumatic central cord syndrome in an older patient with pre-existing cervical stenosis, whereas 16% agreed to operating after 6 weeks. This is in contrast to 96% of the surgeons who agreed that surgery within 24 hours is indicated after a traumatic incomplete spinal cord injury in a younger patient. So two figures in this paper, well worth reading it to go over that important syndrome. Let's go on to number 6. And this has a first author of SAVOR. This is titled Time to Treatment with Endovascular Thrombectomy and Outcomes from Ischemic Stroke, a Meta-Analysis, and this is from JAMA 2016. The authors undertook a meta-analysis of the relation between time to treatment and outcome from endovascular mechanical thrombectomy for acute ischemic stroke. There were 1,287 adults in 5 randomized trials. Compared with medical therapy alone, thrombectomy up to 7.3 hours after symptom onset was associated with improved outcomes. Rates of functional independence after thrombectomy were 64% with reperfusion at 3 hours versus 46% with reperfusion at 8 hours. The magnitude of the association between time to treatment and outcome was clinically meaningful. Based on the current study, and assuming the findings are generalizable to the population of patients with acute ischemic stroke due to large vessel occlusion, among every 1,000 patients achieving substantial endovascular reperfusion, for every 15-minute faster emergency department door-to-reperfusion time, an estimated 39 patients would have a less disabled outcome at 3 months, including 25 patients who would achieve a functional independence, which would be a modified Rankin scale of 0 to 2. So keep in mind that the use of imaging to exclude patients with large core of permanently infarcted brain tissue in the trials in this pooled analysis may have influenced the strength of that association between symptom onset to randomization and symptom onset to reperfusion times and outcomes. 4 of the 5 trials formally excluded patients with large ischemic cores evident on initial brain imaging from study participation. So 2 tables in that and 3 figures, which are graphs. All right, onward. Number 7. This has a first author of Schwett, and it is entitled Thunderclap Headache, and this is from Continuum from 2015. This is an excellent review of the various causes of thunderclap headache. By definition, a thunderclap headache is a severe headache with an abrupt onset, reaching maximum intensity in less than 1 minute. Thunderclap headache is a medical emergency that requires urgent evaluation. The primary differential possibilities include aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage and reversible cerebral vasoconstriction syndrome, or RCVS. Other causes include pretty much everything: infection, cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, cervical artery dissection, complicated sinusitis, hypertensive crisis, intracranial hemorrhage, ischemic stroke, and spontaneous intracranial hypotension. Approximately 70% of patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage present with headache as a main symptom. 50% of patients will present with thunderclap headache. Patients who have thunderclap headache with a non-diagnostic CT and lumbar puncture should be further evaluated with a contrast-enhanced brain MR and non-invasive vascular imaging of the head and neck. So worth remembering are the diagnostic criteria for reversible cerebral vasoconstriction syndrome. So number one, thunderclap headache with or without focal neurologic deficits or seizures. Number two, monophasic course without new symptoms more than 1 month after initial onset of symptoms. Number three, multifocal, multivessel, segmental vasoconstriction of cerebral arteries. Number four, absence of aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage. Five, normal or near normal CSF. And six, complete or substantial normalization of cerebral arteries within 12 weeks of symptom onset. So notable that, you know, making the formal diagnosis may take several time points as these things change over time. A single imaging study showing some vasospasm may not be able to pin down the diagnosis. I've also been impressed in seeing several of these cases recently on both CTA and MRA of how subtle the degree of vasospasm can be. So you really kind of have to up your level of sensitivity in the appropriate clinical context when these patients come across. If you know it's thunderclap headache, you really got to look closely for those areas of mild vasospasm. This has three tables and three figures. Onward to number eight. This has a first author of Turner. It is entitled Uses, Misuses, New Uses, and Fundamental Limitations of Magnetic Resonance Imaging in Cognitive Science. And this is from the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society B, the Biological Sciences, from 2016. This is a very interesting review that tackles numerous questions, so let's go ahead and list some of these. A, what can be learned about cognition from structural and functional bold MRI that other techniques cannot provide? In cognitive studies, some researchers have strongly objected to the practice of statistical mapping of heavily smoothed and thresholded functional brain imaging data, labeling fMRI findings as neophrenology, and committing to the mirological fallacy. The mirological fallacy is ascribing to parts of a system attributes that can only be coherently ascribed to the entire system. Things such as thinking, learning, and calculation can't be simplified to belonging to a brain part. Let's look at B. What are the major flaws in current uses of fMRI? Standard practice in the 90s and extending even to today's research includes spatial smoothing of functional images by 8 millimeters and group averaging. Among several reasons for this procedure, smoothing allowed for the residual mismatch of actual cortical areas after structural brain images had been spatially normalized into a standard template brain registered within MNI space, so that positive results could be anticipated from group averaging across the normalized brains. Spatial localization of activity was usually identified on a maximum probability atlas of Brodmann areas derived from the cytoarchitecture of 10 cadaver brains. C. Are there other ways of analyzing MRI-fMRI data that might provide deeper insight? So we've heard a lot about machine learning, and certainly those techniques can be used to discriminate spatial patterns of brain activity specific to a particular stimulus or task from other related stimuli which do not require spatial smoothing, termed multivoxel pattern analysis. Encoding models begin with providing the experimental subject with a very large number of related stimuli or tasks, which are often naturalistic. These are analyzed into a large set of features. The goal is to determine the functional repertoire of each gray matter voxel as encompassed by a model that characterizes the feature space of that stimuli. Are there developments in MR and fMRI methodology that can minimize the assumptions needed? So there is a new generation of whole body scanners at 17 and above that have shown submillimeter spatial resolution is achievable for structural, functional, and connectivity imaging. For functional, bold, and structural imaging, submillimeter resolution has even been achieved with the latest generation of 3T scanners. Such resolution, consistent with the size of cortical columns, might constitute a threshold regarding realistic mechanistic explanations of brain function. What are the likely fundamental limitations of MR methods? Well, in functional studies, the magnetic fields associated with coherent neural activity is easily observed using magnetoencephalography techniques, but they're too small to be localized using MR methods. The only currently practical way that MR can contribute to studies of brain function is via its sensitivity for the vascular response to neural activity. The MR signal associated with this vascular response can depend upon the blood's velocity, volume fraction, and oxygenation. MR sequences can be designed to be sensitive to one or more of these parameters, but there are fundamental limitations. What are the poorly explored questions relevant to fMRI? Direction of causation. Network models of brain function can only make testable predictions if they include a measurable variable describing the direction of causation between separate cortical or subcortical areas. This is accessible neuroanatomically only in cadaver brains using antegrade or retrograde tracer methods. Columnar organization and sparse encoding versus population encoding are additional areas which need more study. What are the most synergistic other techniques? The author's view is that the most exciting non-invasive technique for quantitative studies of cognition in human brain is the measurement of cerebral blood volume using MRI blood nulling techniques. With the adequate signal-to-noise available at high field, this offers the hope of layer-specific identification of induced neural activity. Alrighty, let's go on to the last paper while we're on a roll for functional. This has a author of Urgerbill, and it is entitled, What is Feasible with Imaging Human Brain Function and Connectivity Using Functional Magnetic Resonance Imaging? And again, this is from the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society B, the Biological Sciences, from 2016. So this article is again another part of the themed issue of Interpreting BOLD, a dialogue between cognitive and cellular neuroscience. This author reviews some of the author's work towards understanding the underlying mechanisms of the methodology, defining its limitations, and developing solutions to advance it. The review covers multiple topics, but I'll just briefly mention one that I sort of understand. Improving the spatial accuracy of fMRI with vascular filters is one topic the author has tackled. Between neuronal activity and receiving the fMRI signal is the neurovascular metabolic coupling. In addition, there's the equally important coupling between cerebral consequences of vascular and metabolic events accompanying neuronal activity and the MR-detected signals that allow us to generate the functional maps. The first is a question of physiology, and the latter involves MR physics. So the primary question here is, does blood flow changes initiated by neurovascular coupling flood a large patch of cortex larger than the territory of neuronal activity changes that cause it? To use a simple analogy, does the brain water the entire garden for the sake of a thirsty flower? The cerebral blood flow experiments have shown, instead of drenching the whole region with flow, the brain waters the thirsty flower, while it also kind of sprinkles a larger territory around it. Now that's kind of an analogy that I might have a chance of remembering. There are several other major topics in this review that are worth pursuing, so I invite you to tackle this paper on your leisure. As usual, these references will be posted on the AJNR blog for more specifics about these articles. Well, that's it for this month. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. I hope you've had a great holiday time. If you have feedback on this podcast, please email me with your criticism or even effusive praise at ajnr.eic@gmail.com. Until next time, thank you so much for listening.